everybody. Welcome to Bone to Pick. I'm Michael Davis, and we are back. We've had a little bit of a hiatus, and I can't think of a better way to get rolling than to sit down with one of the most in-demand, one of the most talented bass players anywhere in the world, the great Jay Anderson, and I do mean great. Jay has toured and recorded with a myriad of artists, including Michael Brecker, Maria Schneider, John Scofield, Bob Brookmeyer, Bob Mincer, Toots Thielemans, Joe Sample, Clark Terry, Kenny Wheeler, Michael Franks, lots and lots of credits in the pop world, including Frank Zappa, Tom Waits, Chaka Khan, Michelle Legrand. He's even played with Allen Ginsberg, the noted poet, and we'll hopefully get him to talk a little bit about that in the interview, with David Bowie as well. He has four albums out as a leader, as well as several where he's collaborated as a leader and a co-leader. He's a recipient of the National Endowment for the Arts grant, as well as two Meet the Composer grants. He is professor of bass at Manhattan School of Music, has been there for many years. He's also on the faculty at New Jersey City University. And I have to say, I'm honored to call Jay a very good lifelong friend, a colleague. I've been very, very lucky to get him to play on some of my projects. And whenever you get Jay Anderson, you know it's going to be as good as it's going to get. He's just one of the best at what he does, and he makes everybody around him better. And I'm also very grateful. My son Cole studied with Jay at Manhattan School of Music and just got a ton out of hearing Jay and being around him. And he's one of the most humble, nicest people you ever meet. So without further ado, Jay, thank you so much for coming to New City today.
Thanks, Mike.
and sitting
Thanks
down and talking about your incredible career. I have to say, this one's been long overdue. I've wanted to sit down with this, so let's jump right in. Maybe talk a little bit about growing up in California. I'm a fan, as you know. I'm a Northern California guy, but from Southern California. Maybe talk a little bit about that.
I usually tell people I'm from Long Beach, because it has a little more street cred.
Sure.
But I'm actually from Anaheim.
Okay.
And got out of there fairly quickly. You know, I had a lot of friends there. Wasn't a big fan of Anaheim. Okay. Just because it was, except for my teachers, my junior high band director, Joe Bearden, who started me playing the bass, and my high school band director, Don Gunderson, who still is a friend.
What made him start when you were in junior high? That's a pretty early for bass, right?
My mom was actually an amazing piano player. Not as a, she just had perfect pitch, and we'd be in the car and she'd hear raindrops keep falling on my head, and then she'd come home and like play it and play it in different keys. And up until she passed away like 8 years ago, she still could do that. So she wanted me to play music, and I took piano lessons from her for a couple of years. That didn't go well. so I was still interested in playing music, so she went to the Joe Bearden, the junior high band director, for a little conference, and she just came home with a bass and said, he wants you to play this. Now, he was a bass player, so he was my first teacher.
Nice.
And he was a jazz guy. And so she brought a bass home, and that's kind of, I'm still, you know, that's not what I wanted to play, but, you know, bass is pretty easy to play pretty well, pretty fast. To play it actually well is hard.
But I was gonna pin you on that point, the first part of that, but you're right, like to play it well, like anything.
Yeah, so, yeah. But, so I could kind of play it pretty fast because I could read music and I was very lame, but I could participate in the school's activities and stuff, you know. So that's how I got started.
Awesome. And then, so you followed that, jumping ahead a few years here, your college time. You went to Long Beach State.
Right.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a lot of good players from Long Beach. I mean, the Martin brothers come to mind immediately, being a trombone player. I'm a big Andy Martin fan.
Yeah.
But the three Stan brothers and Stan.
Scott.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. But what was that experience like at Long Beach State?
It was actually great. You know, John Prince, I didn't get a degree in jazz because I'm embarrassed to say you really couldn't get one then.
Right.
So I studied classical music, and I got a degree in performance playing classical bass. And Tom Kubas was in our big band.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Dan Higgins.
Wow.
Who's like a number one studio guy.
Sure.
Michael Higgins, my dear friend. Jim Cox, very successful piano keyboard person. I'm trying to think of who else. Gordon Peake, great drummer. David Hawker went there. So,
wow, it's a lot of,
you know,
that, a lot of great
that's
players.
Where I kind of, and John Prince, as I said, our band director, he used to write arrangements for the Tonight Show band at the time. Mm-hmm. So that's where I kind of really got an interest in jazz. I knew I wanted to play jazz, but got a degree in classical music. So
cool, very cool. Yeah, let's jump ahead to, you know, like a lot of us of our generation, existed the infrastructure of all the big bands to play on, which is, I'm still, for me, getting to be on Buddy Rich's band. I'm still very grateful for that opportunity. And I know your first big break, we could call it that, was joining Woody Herman and the Thundering Herd in 1979.
I think so.
Something like that.
Maybe late 78, I'm not sure.
You were with him for about a year?
A year. Yeah.
What was that experience like for you?
I mean, I was complete inexperience. You know, I had just like got my own pad, and Woody's band, I think, was in town, and the bass player was leaving. Somebody, and I wish I could remember, because I was trying to remember who recommended me to Bill Byrne, who was the road manager and stuff. And you were recommended. Do you want to play with Woody Herman? And I actually did. You know, I was a fan of The Raven Speaks, and those were the Giant Steps, and Carol Danko was playing, who's a dear friend now. And, it's just a great band. Alfonso Johnson, I think, was playing bass for a minute. And so when they called, I was into it, you know. But as it was probably with you, you just get all your stuff and get on a plane. And my first gig was in Syracuse, and you don't know if you're coming back the next day. Right. You know, and things worked out, so I was on the bus for a year. Never came back to Southern California, and Joe Lovano was there, Gary Smullyan, Jim Powell, great trumpet player.
Was Birch Johnson on that band? Yeah, great.
Who was the guy that I would room with a lot, you know? And so when we finally came back to Southern California, I thought we had a gig at Knott's Berry Farm, which was near my parents' house, you know. Right. So I think this is where I should say goodbye, you know. So I did, and I went up to Woody and told him. I wasn't even sure if he knew my name, you know, after a year. But he was actually super nice and, you know, grateful for, you know, because I did a pretty good job.
I'm sure you did.
And so it was actually a really great experience.
Yeah. I was looking at your discography, which, by the way, in order to print out Jay's discography, I had to put a whole new ream of paper in my printer. But we'll talk about that a little bit more. But did I see that correctly? You were on the Chick Woodrow, the one that was the Steely Dan stuff.
And there was, I think, just two tunes on that.
Okay.
We did FM, which was a Steely Dan. I think they had recorded most of it, the band, right before I joined the band. But we did this tune, FM, and we did, I think we played the theme to the Donahue Show or something bizarre, you know. We were in Wisconsin, and they found a recording studio, and we recorded one day while we were on the road.
Wow, cool.
So it's just a couple tunes.
Cool. Well, then you made the big switch over to Carmen McRae. I know you were with her for
a couple of years.
What was that experience like, and how did that come about? Was it related to the experience on Woody's band at all? Or?
No. The piano player lived in my neck of the woods, a guy named Marshall Otwell. And I forget who was. Ed Bennett was the bass player, I think, right before me. And Joey Barron was playing drums right before me. And she auditioned a new band. Marshall recommended me. And a fellow named Mark Police played drums. And so he and I did it for a couple years, and then it was just time to move on again, so I bailed on that. I think Mark stuck around for maybe 5 more years, and some other stuff was kind of happening. I mean, working with her was amazing. You know, it was, I wish she was alive now and I could play with her now, where I could really appreciate you know, when you're flying around and getting to the gig and listening to her yell at club owners and stuff, you know, it all was kind of a blur. But, you know, just to get to play with her was really an honor.
Yeah, awesome. So 1982, you make the big move to New York City, which sure must have been, you have probably thought, I guess you didn't consider going back to L.A. You said, like, that was not in your
wheelhouse. You know, I had these 3 years after college where I was kind of working, but I never really, I was on the road all the time, so I never really got involved in the L.A. scene. And it wasn't, it was different than it is now. I think like now it's actually a pretty vibrant scene. A lot of great players live there. When I was growing up, I was kind of ready to get out of there.
Okay.
And it just, as things kind of happen for our generation, I think more than it does now, through a series of events, I got called by Toshiko Akiyoshi, which is where we met.
Right, right.
So Toshiko and Lou Tabakin had a big band. She had a trio. And Lou had a trio. So there were three gigs right there. And they had moved to New York. You know, like I was playing with them and they moved to New York. And then I started playing with Red Rodney and Ira Sullivan. And Gary Dial was the piano player who's still my dear buddy today. He recommended me to them and I commuted like for about a year. I lived in LA and Ira lived in Miami and Red and Gary and different drummers lived in New York. And then I thought, man, I've got four gigs. If I am considering moving to New York, this would be the time. So I just packed everything and moved to a little awful, can I say shithole on your interview?
Yeah, right, absolutely.
In Times Square. A little hovel, and I lived there for 5 years and started working more.
What's your, I know I have memories of New York back in the mid-80s, a little bit after you, but what are your memories of the city looking back on it now?
Well, I lived right around the corner. What was the studio at 46th and 10th? Clinton,
sure.
So that I lived right there. Kind of the Times Square area. So it was a very colorful place. A lot of crime.
Yeah.
And I really never had problems. It was just pretty funky. And but I look back at it affectionately. You know.
I look back on 10th Avenue in particular, and nowadays doing a show I live on 9th Avenue and 10th Avenue, right. You know, just walking around, going to restaurants, whatever. But back then, I mean, 10th Avenue was kind of no man's land.
Right.
Certainly 11th Avenue is like, no.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's good to see how the improvement anyway.
Yes.
Let's talk about a couple of, you're staying kind of with the big band idea. And you mentioned Toshiko and, of course, Woody's band. But, you know, you and I became, I think, really good friends from doing Bob Minster's band together. Yeah. And I miss playing in Bob's band every day now, you know, when he got the job at USC, I knew we were in trouble. Just seeing him on a regular basis. But talk about that experience a lot. I mean, you seemed to be the main bass player that that was on most of the recordings.
You may have even been involved before me, I forget.
Hmm. And you did some small group records with Bob as well. But maybe talk about how I was interested to hear your, Bob Minster's a good example, because you did the quartet record, Quality Time, I think it's called. It's a great record. And then all those big band records. Does your approach change when you're playing in a large ensemble to a small group? How do you evaluate that, or is it just kind of an intuitive, instinctual thing?
I think it's more of the latter. You know, I always tell students there are like two non-negotiable things when you're the bass player, right? It has to be in tune, and it has to be in time, and you have to serve the music, whatever it is. You know, so I've done lots of big bands and lots, you know, down to duos, and try to bring the same mentality or mindset or lack thereof to everything. But like playing Bob's music, it's a little more precision. But when you've got soloists like you or Phil Markowitz or any of the saxophone players, you know, you're still improvising mm-hmm. with them and playing, you know, connecting. John Riley was the drummer with Woody Herman, actually. Also, he was the drummer.
Oh, right. Okay.
And we still play together after. Really bugs me. He looks exactly the same. He looks better now than he did when he was 20, you know. I told him that the other day. My hair has thinned a little bit since then. But I try to bring the same. I'm sure, you know, you play lots of different kinds of music and you serve the music, whether it's Mincer or the Rolling Stones, right?
I think it's a great way to put it. I mean, that's the wording I would choose if I was a wordsmith like you. But
I wouldn't go that.
But you got to serve the music. So, and you always have, every time that I get to play with you, you have that ability to, you're obviously serving the music. It's very instinctual and intuitive for you, but also you just have that way of making you're like, using a sports analogy, you're like Larry Bird. You're just making everybody around you that much better. And I think that's largely comes under that umbrella of serving the music, you know.
Yeah.
But that's great. Well, the other big band that you have been associated with for so long and such an incredible band, Maria Schneider Jazz Orchestra,
mm-hmm.
Different musically than
totally
than something
yeah.
than Mincer. Both incredible fans of both bands. What's that been like working with Maria for, that's been quite a number of years now.
Yeah, but you know, one other person I'll mention really quickly before
yeah,
Maria
please.
Is Bob Belden. Did you know Bob?
Of course, yeah, I worked with Bob a couple of times.
And he had a not a big band, but maybe a 10-piece band. And it was Jeff Hirschfield played mm-hmm. drums, Mark Copeland played piano, Jim Powell, just a tuba, French horn. It was just
right.
a really...
Right.
Great music. He did a record called Treasure Island. Now, later he was with Blue Note and did other records, but that record, Treasure Island, is still totally happening.
Yeah.
And, you know, you play the music, but then when people would take solos and improvisation, it was like a quartet, you know. So, with Mark, who's just such an amazing kind of interpreter. My point was going to be that Maria used to come hear that band at Visiones, and she was already composing and doing
right.
stuff. And I think that's where she heard me. And so then she asked me to do a record, and I was like, who is this person? You know, I had no idea who she was, but I was like, well, doing a record, this should be fun. And then the minute I heard, like, the first tune, I was just like, wow, this is some deep shit. You
yeah.
know? And,
yeah.
And it continues to be to this day. It's mm-hmm. just, I don't think of it as you correctly said a large ensemble. I don't think of it as a big band. It's just 21 people playing. You
right,
know?
Right.
And there's so much room for improvisation and, you know, whether it was Ben Maunder or Lage Lewin playing guitar or Frank Kimbrough, God bless him, you know, had as much fun playing with Frank as anybody,
mm-hmm.
loved him dearly. Mm-hmm. Then he passed away, and Gary Versace was playing accordion, and then he moved to the piano chair, and I, you know, to play with those two guys. So when we're blowing, it's not a big band. It's like we're going a lot of different places, and
mm-hmm.
Maria supports that, you know, maybe not to do it during the composed sections, you know.
Right.
But when people are blowing, she's all in on letting us be who we are.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you can hear that in the music, and I couldn't agree more. I mean, jazz orchestra is the way you'd have to describe it. It doesn't feel like a big band in the
yeah.
traditional or even modern sense. You know, it's more, has that orchestral component. And then, of course, like you described, the big amount of improvisational material that it's involved in all of her music. I just have to say one thing about Bob Belden. I did a record for him for this band Incognito.
Oh,
it was
right.
Like, uh-huh. And it was, he did a really great chart. It was like, I can't remember if it was 8 or 9 horns, whatever it was. I didn't really know Bob at all, so I was excited and got to meet him and just loved it. And I just remember him having a pipe on the conductor's podium full of pot, just like
no. Bob Belden smoked pot?
just getting, like, we're not even near the first downbeat, and he's just, like, all in. I'm like, oh, yeah. This is going to go well today. I can feel it. And it did go well.
He too is no longer with us, but just a real character and a brilliant musician.
Absolutely. Really a tragic loss. I mean, very early in this. Yeah.
And my last gig with Woody Herman's band, before they went to Knott's Berry Farm and all that, but was in San Francisco. And that was Belden's first gig.
Oh, is that right?
And for me, it was the best gig I did in a year. And for him, it was the best gig he did in however many years here. So we kind of bonded over that gig. Oh, man, we got to play together. So when we both ended up in New York, we played a lot of music together.
That's awesome. Really great. I'm glad you mentioned him. Let's talk a little bit about Joe Sample. I know he was very important to you in your career. You were with him, if I'm looking at my cheat sheet here, from 1992 to 2006.
Sounds
tons
right.
of recording, touring, obviously. Yeah. What was that experience like working with Joe?
It was great. You know, I, of course, knew of the Crusaders and heard their music growing up, and always liked it. A little more R&B based than the
sure.
stuff I was generally doing, but he wanted to have an acoustic trio, and Matt Pearson, do you know Matt at all?
I know Matt very well. He actually sat down for one of our interviews.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So all the great bass players, you know, but he recommended me to Joe, and I had to audition, and there were like 10 other guys, and I said, well, I'll audition, but I need to be the first guy. I can't walk out and see 10 people sitting there. You know, I just want to come and split, you know. And he did the same thing with Michael Franks. He recommended me to that gig, which I did for many years. But so I got the gig with Joe, and he lived in L.A. And it was an interesting situation because I worked a lot with him. But I was completely, it had nothing to do with the New York jazz scene. You know, so it was probably not a detriment, but just by not being in New York a lot and being on the road with him all the time. But I dug the music, and I thought it was actually quite different to play acoustic bass on his kind of funky Joe Sample tunes, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If it was electric bass, I thought it would be a little more, I don't know. I think the acoustic bass, not that it was me, but just the nature of the instrument put a whole different thing on it. He dug it. I did a bunch of his records, and he was flying me out to LA and touring. And then his son wanted to play bass, and he got okay, Nick Sample, and then I was no longer needed, you know, which was cool. I did it a long time, and I actually learned a lot from him, just about being professional and being on time and just taking care of business. And when he would record his tune, I mean, people don't understand really what a great composer he was, you know, very knowledgeable about harmony and, you know, obviously funky and whatever. But he'd write an arrangement, we'd rehearse maybe twice right before it, and we'd get into the studio, we'd play it, and play it one more time. Do it again. He's like, forget about letter C. Just, you know, he wasn't precious about it. If it didn't work, he just barred it. You know, it's out. And I liked that about his methodology.
Yeah.
You know?
Did he talk much about the Crusaders? Was he still like?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh,
okay,
yeah.
So it wasn't like. Cause I associate you with him with the trio, and you know, but.
Well, I mean, you know, they had those guys went to, I think even. Grade school together. I mean, they were all of those guys.
Oh, wow.
Hubert Laws, they were all from East Houston and played together their whole lives. And Ronnie Laws also.
Right.
And so they had this amazing success with the Crusaders. And then they kind of went their separate ways, and it wasn't all rosy, I don't think. You know, who's going to control the name and so.
Hope everybody's enjoying this outstanding interview with Jay. So much fun hearing all his great stories and about his incredible career. Hey, I just wanted to ask everybody, we appreciate all your support. And please join us on Facebook, join us on our YouTube channel, like us, send us, share it with your friends, and just help us spread the word. We're hoping to keep this thing rolling for as long as we can here, so we'd appreciate any help you can give us. And we're celebrating our 30th anniversary this year. Check out the new Hip Bone Music 30th anniversary hats on our website, hipbonemusic.com. All right, now back to the interview with Jay. I just want to touch on one thing that you said, because I think it's really important. And I think Bob Mincer utilized you in that same way. But having the acoustic bass in that kind of straight eight funky kind of thing, I think Bob did a great job with that too. So what a great sound. I love that. I mean, I'm so in my own music, I try to emulate that in a poor man's kind of way. But I think that's such a... I think that's such a cool sound that and I think I often credit you a lot with that development of that, because that was really like, it just gives it a richness that it doesn't have with the electric bass. Not that there's anything wrong with electric, it's great, yeah. but the body of sound is just like, it's, I don't know, puts a special thing on it. I wanted to do just your, for those of you who aren't familiar with Jay's body of work, take an hour or two out of your day and review the discography, because it is incredible. And he's one of the most humble people, so I'm sure he's not really enjoying me talk about it like this. But I just wanted to do a quick run through of some of the artists that jumped out at me that I was super blown away by. Some you've touched on a little bit, but I just wanted to get you, and like I said before, you can couple sentences or go on as much as you'd like. But Red Rodney and Ira Sullivan.
You know, Mutt and Jeff, you know, completely different people. You know, Ira was this free spirit, you know, he played every instrument.
Right.
And he, you know, he could play trumpet like Clifford Brown or Lester Bowie. You know, I mean, he was a soprano like Train or Lima, you know, just every instrument. And I'm not saying derivative of those people, just in that spirit.
Right.
You know. And so we would be playing free music, and he loved to kind of put us on the spot. I remember playing at the Village Vanguard, and he's like, well, here, have a glass of wine. So I had a glass of wine before the gig, and then he started off playing tune-up. Like, da, 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 da. I mean, like so fast, I don't know anybody that can play that fast. And he's playing the melody, he kind of turned around and looked at me and smiled, you know. So I'm sweating bullets, you know. But I love those guys. Red was completely different. He was more of a bebopper, but he realized that they had known each other 30 years before that. They did a record called The Red Arrow. So they had a long relationship, went their separate ways, came back together. And Gary Dial played piano and composed a lot of the music. And Steve Bagby, Joey Barron, Greg Hutchison, Hirschfield, wow. A lot of drummers came through there. And at some point, Ira moved along. He wanted to stay in Miami more, so Dick Oates was the saxophone player.
Not too bad.
And John Riley, as I mentioned, played in that band too.
Wow.
So.
Cool. Michael Brecker.
Well, you know, that... Adam Nussbaum recommended me to Mike, and I knew him a little bit because I had played some with Randy, and I had played a lot with Eliana Elias, Randy's wife at the time, and so Mike would come to some gigs, so he kind of knew who I was, and I auditioned at his pad, and he asked me to be in his band, and that was just like a real kind of dream come true kind of thing. Our first gig was in Warsaw. One night, maybe 2 years ago, it was, my wife Marianne had gone to bed, and I was looking on my iPad, and I saw a Brecker. Somebody posted, "Oh, that was my first gig," you know.
Oh, wow!
And cool. I memorized everything, so I felt like ready to do it. You know what I mean? I was not really nervous because I had prepared and I knew the music. And, you know, Adam was a good buddy, and Joey Calderazzo, and they had Mike Stern had played guitar right before that, so it was just a quartet, and it was just, you know, It's a couple years, but really a gift to play that music with those guys.
I can imagine. That's amazing. Toots Thielemans.
He's another one, you know, just one of a kind, you know, and the nicest guy, beautiful person, and just the way he played. I mean, I know he had a lot of musical knowledge because you could hear him play the guitar. Mm-hmm. He understood harmony. It just wasn't happenstance or whatever the word is, but he, to hear him play the harmonica, just on anything. He was another true improviser. Mm-hmm. The way he addressed the harmony and the beauty, and we'd play Brazilian tunes. It was heaven, you know. So that was a lot of fun. And that was with usually Kenny Werner and Nussbaum in the group that I played with for a couple of years.
Awesome. Let's delve into some of the pop things you've done, which is also very impressive. David Bowie.
Well, that was just with Maria.
Okay.
That was, you know, she did, he was a fan of Maria and her music, and he would come to gigs, and Maria would say, oh, David Bowie's here. You'd never see him. You know, you knew he was there, and you'd look for him, but he was there, and then he wasn't. And so he asked her to collaborate on a tune, I think it's called Sue, and something in parentheses, in a time of change or something. And so we workshopped that tune with Ryan Keverly, mm-hmm. and Donnie McCaslin and Ben Maunder and Kimbrough and who was the drummer? Clarence Penn was in the band, but he couldn't do it. So I'll think of an amazing drummer, not Gelati, but I'll think of it. But anyway, we workshopped this tune, and it went completely, you know, odd meters and all this stuff. And I was like, really? We're going to do all this shit on this tune? Like, can't we just, like, play the song? And that's what happened. You know, we went through all this stuff, and finally we just kind of played the tune. And when we were in the studio, you know, Frank was there, and a very free-spirited guy. And we're just going to play this shit our way, you know? And so, and they encouraged that, you know? And so we played, I think we just did a couple takes, and we didn't go nuts. I mean, it was very open, and we served the music. From our perspective of some possibilities, and I thought for sure this is going to be cut and pasted and that's all going to go away. They used it exactly as we played it, you know.
Wow.
And he was a lovely guy, and that's the one time I played with David Bowie.
Nice. Sounds like a great experience. Frank Zappa. I can't wait to hear this.
That was a similar thing, that it was just a day of my life. It was the day before I moved to New York. My bass was already here. My stuff was here. And I had a flight early in the morning, and Chad Wackerman, who was his drummer, Frank wanted to redo some tunes, so Chad recommended me. I got to his home, like maybe at 10 in the morning, and it was just the engineer and me and Frank. And he just he had won a lawsuit, I think, with Warner Brothers or something. He got the rights to a lot of his music back, and just wanted to put acoustic bass on a bunch of stuff. So I'm not sure, but probably recorded 20 tunes.
Wow.
Not a sheet of music, just, you know, most of it was just free. And there were a couple old Mothers of Invention tunes where I had to listen and kind of learn a bass part and did that. And he probably smoked 5 packs of cigarettes. You know, I was there, I think, for about 12 hours. And great cat, totally cool, set up a lovely vibe. So I was a little nervous with the idea of doing it because I thought he was going to play the Black Page or something.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And Chad had told me about that side of him. To be honest, I hadn't really heard his music. It's not something that was in my sphere. But it was really fun, and it was great. And I have to mention John Hettle, a guy from your neck of the woods, a bass player, let me use his bass. I got to give him a plug.
Nice, nice. Wow, that's cool. Okay, this is the perfect one to end on. And who has this on their resume? Allen Ginsberg, the noted poet.
Yes. Well, that too was an hour of my life. I was playing at a place called Caravan of Dreams, and I think it was in Fort Worth, Texas. And Ornette had been instrumental in helping curate stuff. I forget what his relationship was with the club was, but they had a cactus garden on the top floor. And I was playing there with Toshiko Akiyoshi and Bob Moses. And it was like an arts center and a restaurant and bar. And so we were at lunch. We flew in from the airport. We were at lunch. And our host said, Allen Ginsberg is playing in the other hall tonight. You come over and meet him. And I was like, I had no idea who he was. I think Bob Moses was there, right? So I said, who is this guy? He's a famous poet, you know, like a beat poet, groundbreaking, like one of the cats of that generation, right? So we went over and met him, very nice. He said, what time is your gig tonight? And I told him the time. He goes, well, mine's an hour earlier. You want to come play with me? And I said, okay, what are we going to play? He's like, that doesn't matter. Just bring your bass. So I get there, and he's like, just, you can smell the weed like 100 yards away. And I knocked on his room, and I said, oh, I'm here. He's like, oh, great, you know, we're going on in 5 minutes. Cool. So, and he had his harmonium, you know, I love that instrument. Mm-hmm. And I just played with him. He turned out he did this poem, Howl, which is, I later found out, considered like a hallmark piece from the Beat generation. And, you know, I asked him, what do you want from me? He's like, whatever, he didn't care. He was just like happy to have another person there, you know. So I would be interested to hear what that sounded like. But anyway, that was my hour with Allen Ginsberg. And I actually ran into him in the Village maybe 5 years later and stopped him and felt like I was kind of intruding on his privacy, you know. But so you probably don't remember me, but I played bass with you at Caravan of Dreams. He's like, oh, man, you know, he was like totally nice and remembered. Uh-huh. Know, I don't think he remembered my name or anything, but he remembered playing with me, which is incredible, considering how much weed I'm sure he smoked right before that gig. But, yeah, it was really fun.
Wow. You know? Talk about it. Well, if it was only an hour, talk about a memorable, cool hour. Yeah. I mean, that's awesome. That's great.
That I was actually a little nervous for because I had no...
Just the lack of information that you had to go with.
I feel like, you know, you play with somebody. Like these days, I would have Googled him and listened to his body of work and kind of some idea. But this was like 30 years ago or something.
Right. You know, so. Awesome. Let's talk a little bit about your solo projects. You've got four as a solo, as a leader, I should say, and then several as a co-leader. I guess I would just ask you some of your favorite projects that you've done of your own that you feel strongly about.
Well, I'm actually proud of all of them.
I would think so, yeah.
The early ones that were for the DMP label, which Mitzer recorded for, and I used to play a lot with Warren Bernhardt, pianist extraordinaire, and those were on the DMP label.
Right.
So I kind of knew Tom Jung through those, and forget if he asked me or I asked him. I actually had music kind of ready, and so my music was quite left of center from the direction that he was going, but he tolerated it, and you know, did lovely recordings of it, and so. They're, you know, 92 and 94.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole different aesthetic. I use synthesizers on some, and Tim Higgins played on one, Randy Brecker played on the other, Billy Drews played saxophone on both of them, Hirschfield played drums on both of them, Wayne Krantz played guitar on one of them, and my good friend David Witham played keyboards on both. Awesome. So,
yeah, I have those somewhere, and unfortunately, my CD player died in me about 3 months ago, so now I'm scrambling to find it.
And, you know, I used to compose a lot, and I almost feel I've been so fortunate to play with so many great musicians, great composers, specifically Maria, Bob. Kimbrough is a great composer. I played more recently with a guy named Enrique Hanini. Do you know him? He plays drums and piano. Ridiculously talented guy. Some of the hardest music I've ever played, you know. But I don't feel like I have that much to bring to the table as a composer, you know. So I've been busy playing, busy being a husband and other stuff. So
that's great that you documented. I disagree with you. I think you do bring a lot as a composer, but it's good that you documented some of those on those records.
I feel
good
about
it. It's great that they're there. Shifting again, let's talk a little bit about your teaching side of things and what things are like at MSM these days, and also at Jersey City University.
Yeah.
What's I know, I'm very grateful because of my son Cole and how much he got to study with you and learn from you, and I know you.
I learned a lot from him too. Really, and you know that's true.
You know, I think you give a lot to all your students, but what's things on your teaching front these days?
Well, I've done millions of workshops around the world, like clinics in the context of traveling and all that. MSM, I've been there for 25 years.
Wow, okay.
And it's an interesting study in life because, you know, I get older and the students keep coming in, you know, they're still like 18 to 24. Or whatever it is. So the disparity between my experience and their experience widens. But, you know, I've seen a lot of stuff online lately about teachers complaining about their students. I don't know if you've seen any of that stuff. Oh, they don't want to get up at 9 a.m, which is all true. But, you know, I've had a lot of students, and almost without exception, they've all been great to work with. And I don't, I grab a bass, they grab a bass, and for better or worse, we just play. Because I feel like so much of playing the bass is, you know, like with Cole, he was a great bass player, you know, and got around the instrument. So if people have bad intonation or can't get around the bass, or they are awkward standing with the bass, or their weight isn't evenly distributed, I'm happy to work on any of that stuff. I try to present opportunities. Some people come in with gut strings and want to play like Paul Chambers. That's cool. You know, I try to present some options. There is all this other music over here that you might want to make yourself aware of and be able to deal with should it come up. And then conversely, there's people that just want to play whoever the latest hot person is and have no, they don't care or understand what has come before. And I always feel like the continuum of jazz, whatever that means, is really important. You know, so when I hear somebody play, I want to feel like they understand harmony and voice leading and play in tune, have a good sound, their sound. You know, I try to bring out whoever is there. And but sometimes it's pretty unstructured. Mm-hmm, I would say it's always unstructured, which would be, you know, like not my strength, you know. But I feel like I'm generous and I kind of do can assess people pretty quickly and ask them what their professional and personal interests are so I can serve what it is they want to do.
Everybody that I know, obviously, Cole, but have studied with you over the years always talks about how open you are with, you know, your approach and what bringing them in. And I think that's really essential now. You know, back in our day, teachers could have a different way of looking at it and a little more structured, or whatever word you want to use for it, narrow kind of focus. And it was appropriate for the time, but I think now is having that openness is great. And obviously you've had a lot of success with that. So.
Well, and I can speak to Cole. I'm sure you don't care.
No,
I mentioned your son. You know, he has a very kind of innovative way of dealing with the upper register of the instrument. And, you know, I was like, man, you got to go with that, you know. Mm-hmm. And he was always like, well, I'm going to graduate next year. What am I, you know, he was always very focused on what's going to happen after school.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I said, I don't know, but I have complete faith in you. And he's proven me right, because he, you know, for us, the phone rang. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
I feel like, you know, we talked about all this stuff, but I didn't really hustle. The phone rang. I was like, okay, I'll be there. You know, if it was something I wanted to do, and it was fortunately good music generally, but I feel like young people these days have to be much more proactive.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to say my jazz education, like I said, I didn't study jazz, was just apprentice-based, you know, learning on the bandstand and trying to do a lot of listening and making up for lost time in Anaheim. These people now have like a lot of experience playing and play the instrument great, but have no idea of just what might be asked of them professionally, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's different for everybody, but I try to go with that, you know.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned him freaking out about what's going to happen. And I remember him calling me and saying pretty much the exact same thing. He's like, Dad, I'm really freaking out about what's going to happen here. And he goes, it's really weird. Like, all my classmates, none of them are concerned at all. And I said, well, a couple of things. I'm almost 60, and I'm still, at the time, almost 60, and I'm still freaking out pretty much on a regular daily basis. So I would just get used to it.
Yeah.
And then don't worry about what everybody who thinks everything is going to be rosy and paved for them, because that's certainly not the way this business is now. And like you just said, they've got to be more proactive. And somehow
things work out.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, he's done so much stuff online, and I watch it. Whenever I see he has posted something, I check it out, and I'm like, better him than me. He'll play Michael Brecker solos, and I'm like, wow, I could barely play the bass line, much less his solo one like you tune.
Yeah,
you
know? I know.
So it's pretty astounding.
His work ethic is astounding. He'll call me and, what are you working on today, Dad? And I'm like, a hangover? But anyway, Jay, it's been so awesome to sit down with you today and just your stories
and
just putting all the kind of a visual image to all this amazing work you've done. And you're still a young guy, and so much to come for sure. As we close out, is there anything left on your musical bucket list that you hope to do or planning on? Or
I just, you know, want to keep playing good music. You know, I know Maria it continues to work, and I really do love being part of her world.
Sure.
I just quickly will want to mention two dear friends of mine passed away during COVID, Frank Kimbrough and Vic Juris, who
of course.
I played maybe on 14 of Vic's recordings. He was a dear friend. And so one of the things about getting older, I guess, and I'm sure you've experienced it, you know, Mincer moved to California. A couple of my dear friends had passed away. Others have gotten sick, you know, so I mourn that, you know, but I'm also aware of this guy, Enrique Hanini. Love him, love his music, super challenging. So, you know, he sent me music a year ago that he wants to record. I still practice it like all the time, and I'm about 80% there, you know. So, but I just want to keep playing good music, and that's about it.
I have no doubt that is going to be the case, because if you're willing to pick up the phone or look at your email, the calls are going to keep flooding in as they have for decades. And For those of you who don't know all of Jay's solo stuff, I encourage you to check out his website, jayanderson.com. jayandersonbass.com. And also, do take a look at the discography. It's not to be equaled by too many people down the road. But I hope everybody enjoyed this as much as I did getting to sit down with Jay. And we will see everybody next time on Bone to Pick.
Thanks, Mike.